Wow.
I can't wait.
You can't wait, no. Don't go swimming in the sea, because a few days ago, somebody got eaten up by a shark. There's not one piece even left of her.
Oh, God, I haven't read about that. That was horrible.
Giant shark. It was, like, amazing.
So, I'm just warning you. And there was another awful accident in the game park. There was a buck running along at a terrible rate, and he passed some lions that were asleep, and he ran right into a tree and dropped dead.
My goodness.
So, Glenn, which constituency gets some meeting rooms next to the beach and being fed to the shark?
Yes, exactly.
I understand, by the way, that half of Bush's cabinet has made them, after resigning, has made themselves available to assist ICANN with its strategic plans for the next 3 years. So I expect to see Colin Powell, as well as John Ashcroft and the former secretary.
Oh, don't wish John Ashcroft on us. Good God.
Well, John Evans.
As long as the headline isn't mission accomplished, I guess.
I think that Don Evans has left the cabinet as well, so the Commerce Secretary might be available as well. So, you know.
I think we've actually got a fairly good turnout right now.
Why don't we go ahead and get started?
Ken, Ross, Thomas Risler, Brian, Barbara, and Greg Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hello, Greg Ruth.
Hello.
Have we got anybody from business and non-commercials?
I'm surprised Sarah isn't here, but I'm sure that Greg can reach over the wall there.
I never see Sarah.
Sarah might be traveling. I'm not sure. But in any event, last week I had said I was going to circulate something after the call to try to incorporate everybody's comments. But in looking at it, I didn't do that because I guess I felt like some of what Ross was proposing that at least at this point I don't think the IPC would be willing to go along with. So... It seems to me, obviously we can talk about whatever people would like to talk about today, but it might be more fruitful if we take everything that's on the table now from, I guess, the IPC, the registrars, the registries, any other constituency, and the BC's comments, have a workshop in Cape Town to try to hammer out some of these remaining issues. Because, I do think we're close enough that there's a possibility of coming up with a recommendation, but I didn't really see the point in taking, the various comments and then just indicating what would be, acceptable or not to the IPC, because I don't know that would really advance the ball, and it might be useful if we get reasonable turnout in Cape Town to try to hammer something out then. What do you all think about that idea?
I'm not sure I understand the scope of the proposal, Brian. Are you indicating that we're going to open up the work of the task force to the GNSO, or I'm not sure how that... I'm just not sure what it is that you're asking us to do.
No, I'm talking about a workshop in Cape Town for the task force to take the various drafts and ideas that are on the table and try to reach some kind of consensus at that time face-to-face. I think that might be more productive than just passing back and forth proposals where we're not really coming to an agreement. And I didn't think it would advance the ball if I took what you had proposed and then sent it back and said, well, the IPC doesn't like these three ideas at this point. I mean, we've kind of done that a few times, and maybe it would be better and more productive if you get the representatives of the task force in a single room or a single location to talk about some of these issues and see if they can, reach some consensus.
So I guess my next question would be, who from the task force is going to be in Cape Town?
That's an important question. There will be somebody there from the IPC. I will not be there, but you know that shouldn't be a problem. What about the other constituencies?
Well, I'll be there. This is Greg Ruth.
Ken Stubbs, I'll be there.
I would imagine somebody from the BC will be there.
Some people from ALEC will be there. I have a suspicion that Victoria will be busy doing chairman's work, and I won't be there. So we can try to send someone, but I don't know who.
So it sounds like we'll be able to get a fairly good turnout. My only concern is that we end up with 500 people in the same room. So to the extent that we're limiting this to the task force membership, I think that's a valid proposal.
Yeah, I think that would be, it seems to me that would be more productive. What do you all, Barbara, what do you think about that? What's our ability to have a meeting limited just to the task force membership or, you know, alternates or other designees?
I think that's perfectly appropriate. We sort of did something that was a little bit broader than that in KL, where we, Bruce tried to organize going through the different task force recommendations from their reports, and I'd say there were probably, Glenn, about, 30 people in the room? No more than that. And most of them were participants in the task forces, one of the three task forces.
Yes.
But I think if you wanted to limit, you know, have a meeting that was just the task force participants or their representatives, that would be fine. I would suggest that you might want to set a couple of different potential goals for objectives for this meeting. You know, one could be certainly the ideal objective would be to come up with a consensus recommendation, but a secondary objective might be that if that's really not possible, if there is no reconciling the IPC position and the registrar's position, that you that we craft, you know, exemplary descriptions of what those positions are to forward to council to you know, have them see if they can hash out some kind of consensus agreement. I just think having some kind of a fallback position to total success might be really helpful in this regard.
No, that's fine. I mean, I think we could do that. I think that would make sense.
My only concern, Brian, is what makes us think that the output from that workshop is going to be any different than the output that we've seen over the last 6 months in these conversations we've been having?
You know, I don't know. I think there might be some beneficial effect if people are in the same room, face-to-face, and able to work through some of these ideas. If there's a possibility of doing that, and given that we're close, it seems to me that it's worth the effort.
Fair enough. I would only say that, you know, I'm kind of I am very disappointed that we're having this call today, and we've got actually a fairly good turnout, and we're not having a conversation about substantive issues. I don't mind doing forward planning. I don't mind putting us in a position where we might be able to succeed. But we've made zero progress over the last month, and
that's not true, Ross. Because we put a proposal out there. We got some comments from the Beast.
All right, we've made no progress. That's fine.
We can talk about.
We've made progress. Whatever. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, we can talk about your ideas. I mean, I can tell you just what the IPC view is on some of these things that you've indicated. If you think that would be helpful at this point.
Well, that's sort of what I thought the purpose of these calls were for, so absolutely I would think it would be useful.
Yeah, okay. You indicate that the registrars aren't required to collect facsimile contact data, and therefore that shouldn't be one of the data elements to be verified. Well, it is commonly provided, and since it would be one of several data elements that could be verified, it doesn't seem to me or the IPC that should be taken out. Because if there is a fax number provided, that's something that a registrar can select among the other data elements to verify. So that's one point. And that would be consistent to both the 1A and 1B of the, you know, prior draft. The permanent failure delivery, your section 1A2,
mm-hmm.
that's probably fine. You know, I think that would be okay. We would prefer that there be at least two data elements instead of one. That's an area where you wanted to reduce it to just one element. IPC would prefer two. And then I think we need to work out of the task force the issue of placing the domain name on hold, and you know, what is the hold, the registrar versus the registry hold that we talked about very briefly at the end of the call last week. As far as the BC's comments, you know, I think we could easily address those. They didn't look to be that complicated. And I think there the hold issue would be the most significant. So we can talk about any of those points if people would like to discuss that now.
Well, is it that people don't have strong opinions about this, or is it that they aren't prepared to give their constituency's point of view on this?
I have very strong views on the subject, but I'm trying to leave the floor open for others, for other voices
at
this point.
Well, I would like to hear what Ross has to say.
Yeah. Sure. Ross, you want
to? Happy to pick up the mic if nobody else has any comments. I'd like to push a bit on your notion that this data is commonly collected, Brian, or as it relates to fax data. Can you just unpack that a bit? I don't understand it. I'm not sure where you're getting that from.
I base it solely on anecdotal information. I mean, I don't have the statistics, but it just seems to me every time I've gone to the WHOIS database, I've seen fax numbers. So, you know, they're there. and I'm assuming somebody's providing them, and that somebody would be the registrant. So that's the sole basis for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd submit that it's an inaccurate view of the WHOIS data. Contractually, registrars have no obligation to collect that data. As a result, we typically do not collect that data. And requiring us to validate that data when it's not universally present, or even present in the majority of cases, or even in a noticeable minority of cases, to me, just, I think it's an inappropriate requirement.
But Ross, it's not a requirement. It's just a data element that if the registrar elects, it can that as one of the things to verify. It's not a mandatory obligation. It wouldn't be worded as such. So there's no downside to including it because it just gives the registrar an additional option. It so chooses.
Well, no, it's not. Sure, fair enough. No, that's not the case, Brian. It would have the effect of requiring us to check at minimum 2 out of 3 data elements, as opposed to 2 out of 4 that you think you're proposing. Requiring us to check 2 out of 3 data elements in every single instance of a complaint is inappropriate.
That's a separate issue, then.
What's the same? How is it a separate issue?
It's a separate issue from the fax number. The first issue is, can fax be one of the data elements that can be chosen by the registrar to be verified? It seems to me that that's a permissive choice on the part of the registrar. So there's no really need to delete it. Obviously, if a registrant has not provided a fax number, there's no obligation or even option to check the fax number. So I think that issue is a non-issue. Now, the issue of 2 versus 1, checking 2 as opposed to 1 data element, that's a real issue, and I guess I would be interested in hearing what other people have to say about that. I mean, I know your view, and I understand why you want 1 data element. The IPC wants 2 data elements because 1 data element may not really do much to ensure accuracy. And so that's our view, and you have your view, and I'm sure you have good reasons for your view. But it seems to me if we're not checking data accuracy at the time of the registration, and we're only checking it in response to a complaint, you know, the IPC position is, well, let's check, you know, at least 2 of the elements. And I guess I'd be interested in hearing what other people think about that.
Thomas,
yeah,
can I go from the queue, please?
Stuff, put me in the queue after Thomas, please.
Thomas, go ahead.
I'm rather concerned about having facsimile in there in the manner it is in there currently, because after all, it is an optional data element. So we suddenly have a situation in which, assuming that the registrar elects to verify the fax number, according to this policy, a domain name would be put on hold, whatever that means. I think this is unclear still. Would be put on hold on the basis that a voluntary data element is wrong, inaccurate in some sense. And this gives me a major headache. I would be opposed to having this conclusion. What I could, on the other hand, imagine is that if a registrar can verify a facsimile number that is given, that if the facsimile number works, then accuracy requirements are fulfilled. That would sound reasonable to me, and that's what you, Brian, claim the policy to do. Unfortunately, right now, the policy has a different effect. We have to distinguish between data elements which can put a domain name on hold if inaccurate, and at the same time, which can be cause for a complaint, and between data elements which can be sufficient.
So you're saying then
it can be sufficient to fulfill accuracy requirements, which are on registrants at this point. By the way, so
that I understand your position, you're saying that where a domain name registrant voluntarily elects to provide a facsimile number, the registrar can use that facsimile number, and if it works, use that as one of the data elements for verifying accuracy. But if it doesn't work, it cannot be a basis for putting the domain name on hold.
Precisely that. If it doesn't work, extract the fax number from the Whois data if you want. But that's the most in terms of sanctions that I would find appropriate here, because, of course, you have always a problem, what is a permanent failure of a fax number? Is a permanent failure of a fax number when there is no paper in it for a week? Is a permanent failure of a fax number when it's busy every time people try to call it? You have some definition problems here in particular, so I'm very reluctant to find it. I'm very reluctant to suggest putting any sanctions to not working fax numbers.
Okay. Can you want to comment?
Your email, by the way.
Yeah. I'm going to take a step back, and I'm going to try to act in a somewhat observer status here. Every time we have these phone calls and every time we have meetings like this, we always have either an elephant in the room or an elephant on the phone call. The elephant is economics. And also, I think what we have in some cases, and I'm not necessarily taking one position or the other, is a lack of understanding of the impact of some of the proposals. And what we just talked about is a perfect example of this. Please understand, I know absolutely nothing about writing code, but I sure as hell hate to have to write code for a reseller system to cover the examples that you just went through for fax. Faxes is a perfect example. The cost to administer something like this, the cost to migrate to a system like this, is a very substantial cost. And I really think, and it's just my opinion, and Ross, you can slap me down and tell me I'm way off base if you'd like, that a significant amount of the problems that are involved here have to do with the fact that to implement some of the stuff that you're talking about, both of you, either one way or the other, and to deal with the exceptions that were perfectly just the ones that were just pointed up there alone, it's just not a very practical approach to take to a system that's pretty well been in place now for, let's say, 3, 4, 5 years. And, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I still think that to a great extent that's where some of these problems lie. I can use this, I'll use my observation of, let's say, VeriSign or TuCows, or not VeriSign, Network Solutions or TuCows or Cores or anyone else's system. When you're dealing with hundreds or thousands of resellers something like that, it seems to me to be a significant problem. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think that's a great summary, Ken.
Well, where does that leave us? If the main consideration is that on the part of the registrars, there's a reluctance to take on costs that are regarded as onerous for, you know, judging from Ross, your emails, for a task that is seen to have limited value in furthering the process of making the data more accurate. And the IP constituency sees this as a way to address inaccuracies that are, you know, that are identified, then what's the way forward in balancing those two things?
I think there is a third point to be considered in balancing things on this task force, and the third point is quite clearly the stability of domain names. There tends to be an assumption in these task forces that complaints are legitimate. They are not. Complaints are fairly easy. So we end up in a system, or may end up in a system, where complaints are put in place to annoy registrants and to take down domain names. Say, you know someone is lying in a hospital, is uncontactable, so fine, you put a domain name complaint, a WHO security complaint in place. This person won't respond within 2 weeks, maybe, and the domain name is gone. This is a stability concern, and this is what, it is a registrant concern, which I was also hearing from Sarah Dodge's email. So the third point here is stability of of legitimate registrations against fraudulent accuracy complaints, and that's one which I find insufficiently taken into account, in fact, in the draft from the IPCC. So just to clarify that, it's three parts to balance, not two.
Thomas, what's your data on these fraudulent...
One point is that there are anecdotal reports on this. Another point is we are talking about designing a system here. We are designing a system where a path to abuse is visible, and where this path to abuse comes with economic incentives. That means we are designing an unsafe system and a system which should not be put in place. You don't design a system or a business process where you know there's people out there who may have an economic interest to abuse the process, and still you leave the door wide open to abuse. You don't do that. Doing that means endangering stability of domain name registrations, and as we can read in the strategic plans is priority one right now. So, please, it's not what's the statistic on fraudulent reports or complaints, but it is what can happen when there is a fraudulent complaint. How easy is it? Where are the safeguards? The safeguards are close to none. The timelines are too short. The definitions of failure are far too loose. And the incentives are put in a way so domain names can easily lapse and it can easily be abused. That's, once again, not a system you put in place.
What about fraudulent complaints, though? That's
the
flip side of the coin, isn't it?
What? I don't get your point. I'm sorry.
But what about fraudulent domain name registrations? I mean, that's the problem we're trying to deal with, right?
Yeah.
I thought we were trying to deal with data accuracy, Brian.
Well, yeah, we are. But that's certainly one manifestation of it.
So, Ross' comment has an important implication. He's actually right. And there is a difference between fraudulent domain name registrations and data accuracy, or dealing with these two topics. If you are dealing with data accuracy, what you want to achieve is to have accurate data in the database. What you are not trying to achieve is less domain names in the zone file. If you're dealing with fraudulent registrations, and only with these, what you ultimately want is to get people out of the zone file. that's an important difference here. You can, of course, improve data accuracy without endangering existing domain names. You can do that by operating registration services in a more user-friendly way, by making it easier for users to update their information. But you don't improve data accuracy by just kicking out people randomly, to put it very pointedly.
Well, it wouldn't be random, but Ross, go back to your point about the fax number. So if we don't have the fax number, what are we left with in terms of verifying? Phone, email, and postal address?
Well, I can give you a precise answer if I can take 2 seconds. just bear with me here.
Ross, just I know what you're looking up is one of the requirements, but the heart of your suggestion is that the accuracy be limited to those items that are required for collection.
That's correct.
Not
it would be possible. Email, phone, and postal mail. I'm looking at your revised version.
Yeah.
And which I'm happy to amend as appropriate. I actually haven't looked at the required data elements in a while.
Yeah, I mean, it might even be worth stating as the required data elements as opposed to what they specifically are, because if that were to change, you wouldn't want to have to go in and change this particular requirement. You know what I mean?
So then the issue becomes whether it's one or two of the required data elements, right?
So required data elements at this point are email, postal mail, and phone.
They are specifically the name and postal address of the registrant. The name and postal of the registrant. 3.3.1.6.
If you're talking
we
about
also have a requirement to gather the name, postal, email address, voice, telephone number, and fax for the technical and administrative contact.
Fax, if available. There's a parenthesis in there, I'm almost sure.
So that's for the technical and administrative contacts, yes.
Yes. Fax, if available. Email is for email and phone are obligatory for the contacts, right? Not for the registrant, but I think with some sick registries, you have some inconsistencies there.
But there's a large distinction between the technical contact and the registrant, Thomas.
Yeah, I mean, this does introduce an interesting problem. If we were to go with more general language of require, you know, of verifying one or two of the elements and the required data elements, there's a couple of issues. You know, required data elements for the registrant or for the technical contact, that becomes one issue. The other issue is that may be different for different registries, right? Different.
No, this is consistent for this is consistent across the. That's incorrect. I'm sorry for not correct. There may be inconsistencies across registries. That's right.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. The difference between
The appendix to this agreement for a particular TLD may substitute language for the subsections as applicable to that TLD. It's been the basis that I've been proceeding on is that we've been talking about registrants and not technical contacts here.
Right,
That has been unclear, that is something that we should discuss. But
I think we should just make it explicit in the policy recommendation, that's all. I guess my second point about it potentially being different across different domains, is that seen as a problem, or is that acceptable, that the more general, because I think the more specific we get, like saying, you know, being explicit about postal address or phone or email, that does tie us to those particular data elements when the whole question of what data elements are gathered may change.
Yeah, but isn't Ross saying, I mean, if you did that, didn't you just say, Ross, that the only required data elements for the registrant are name and postal address?
That's correct.
And so you're saying that you would no longer even verify an email? I think we should leave email in there, shouldn't we?
Well, it's not connected. Registrant email is, strictly speaking, not collected in particular in .com.
And truth be told, Brian, I care only about .com. What happens with info is an interesting and academic discussion at this point for my business.
Right.
And that's no slight against any member of your constituency, Ken. Please don't take it that way. But we're dealing with millions upon millions upon millions of registrants in .com, and they represent the vast majority of cases that we deal with today. And I'm happy to right-size whatever it is that we do for .com for those other TLDs as appropriate. If that means we need to make amendments and modifications to suit those registries and their unique implementations, let's deal with that
as it comes up. Yeah, they all
make sure first and foremost that we deal with .com specifically. And if it doesn't we can't move forward with it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on you there.
No,
they all do require the postal address, though. I think that's a common denominator to all of them. The differences come with that some require more things as opposed to the very minimal ones that are in the .com agreement. Well, so if we were to limit it to registrant contact information that is required, then the only data element that is available for verification would be name and postal address. And so that makes moot the question of whether it's one or two data elements that you confirm. But I think that it does raise the issue of whether that's the appropriate direction to go, given that postal address may be the most difficult one to confirm at times. You know, it's certainly more difficult to confirm a postal address in times of natural disaster and things like that.
I think it
leaves us with a pretty, pretty basic question: is if we limit it to required data elements, then we're saying that postal address is the only thing that could be required to be verified, and I think that is unsatisfying on a number of levels. In part because it seems like it doesn't offer enough protection to registrants, because that may be a difficult way for them to confirm the accuracy of their data, and it also may not prove beneficial to the IP constituency's concerns about actually verifying that there's somebody on the other end of those registrations, and so I think that it's sort of a decision that has to be made. I actually think this is a very clear decision that has to be made about whether to go with the stricter language or to be more generous about ways for people to verify their accuracy and registrants to verify their accuracy. And if we take the more generous approach, then the question becomes which data elements are the ones that can be used, and do you have to verify one or more than one of those data elements?
But doesn't that, but then at that point, aren't we then left with the same conversation we're having now, once we get into those specifics?
Well, but then I think you're on better ground for actually making the decision at that point. It's like when it was just a suggestion to use, you know, fax or phone or email or postal address, that those were just all the data elements that were available in a potential registration. And what we're saying now is, if we go beyond the minimal required elements, then we have to have some justification for the ones that we choose. So if we say, you know, phone and email are two, you know, other ways that they could verify the accuracy, then what's the justification for choosing those two and not choosing fax? You know, and because they're more readily collected, or because they're more easily verifiable, or because they're less prone to, you know, be as changeable as a fax machine, or, you know, whatever the justification is, I think that it does require some justification to move beyond the required data elements, but that once you've made that decision, then you have to, you know, you have to create the justification, or you have to demonstrate the justification. And I think in this case there probably is a need to move beyond the required single data element of postal address, because that there are inherent difficulties with postal addresses.
I think that's fair to say from an economic standpoint, but I'm still left with questions, philosophically speaking, whether that's a necessary step.
Right.
So while I would definitely concur with the analysis that Ken put forward, I think the elephant in the room has a slightly different character than that,
right,
at least at this standpoint, at this point.
Yeah. What about verifying the email contact for the administrative or technical contacts?
So moving it beyond the scope of just the registrant to some other participant in the domain name maintenance?
There's no guarantee that email address is associated with the domain holder today.
Right. And I think Brian's recognizing that. He specifically said admin or tech contact.
Yep.
So I think that, you know, we all understand that verifying that the admin contact or the tech contact is accurate doesn't necessarily get you to the registrant. You know, so I guess the question then, Brian, is that information on accuracy of value to the IP constituency's point of view of what they're testing accuracy for?
Well, no. I mean, I think the goal is to be able to contact the registrant, and that's the ultimate issue.
Well, I suppose, though, if you could verify that the admin or tech contact information was accurate, you would at least know how to reach the person responsible for the administration of that domain. So that if your concern was phishing or some other misrepresentation or bad act on the part, you know, that was being attributed to the domain, you'd at least have a way of contacting the administrator of that domain.
Yeah, that's one option.
But let's not lose sight of the fact that the administrator of the domain name and the administrator of the email server or the website or the insert name of internet service here are often not the same people. As a matter of fact, I can guarantee that there is a million spams out there today with twocows.com associated with them that have nothing to do with my admin contact.
Right, you just provide mail services for them or something, yeah.
No, that somebody has decided to appropriate one of our domain names and send out underneath their name.
Yeah, there's that problem also.
It happens all the time to almost everybody who has a domain name that's sufficiently long around.
Right.
Add viruses to that. I guess we are back to the question that bounced between Ross and Brian, namely, are we interested in dealing with fraudulent registrations as defined as the really bad guys which must be taken offline in 3 hours, or are we talking about ensuring accuracy? I have a strong feeling that we are not going to find a process that does both things at the same time. You can't use a general accuracy challenging process which has to be designed for the millions of domain names that are open for challenge and are entirely legitimate to handle a couple hundred or a couple thousand which are illegitimate and need to be taken offline quickly. It's just entirely different requirements that you get, and you don't want to use the same process for that.
If you
want to really go for people who do phishing, you want to contact the ISP, which is sitting upstream from them. You get the information from IP address who is.
You want to
contact the registrar and tell them, they have inaccurate Whois data, please challenge. You're going to tell them, these people are using my trademark name. They are defrauding people, and by the way, it's pretty obvious that this is going on. Do something. This is going to be an out-of-band process. This is not going to happen through an ICANN process that has to be designed for the generic case.
Yeah, Thomas, I think your point is really good, that really well said, that trying to craft the policy to do both things is probably unworkable at this point. I simply don't think we're all going to agree on appropriate terms under which to do it that way. The other problem that we're running into, though, is not we meaning on this task force, but I mean just in general, that the IP address Whois database is undergoing change at the same time as we're talking about changing requirements in the DNS database. And they are actually removing contact information.
Barbara, what level are they removing contact information on the leaf?
Yeah, they're removing contact information at a pretty, it's getting further and further up the food chain. It's now the ISP, if they allocate the addresses to a further downstream ISP, all they have to indicate is that the further downstream ISP has the addresses. And that ISP, if they choose to become the technical contact for all of their addresses, only doesn't have to designate who the addresses belong to.
Well, okay, you can get through to some entity that is able to put a throttle on an address or is able to call someone, right?
That's theoretically, yes.
The design in the IP Whois is still so that you can get somewhere upstream from the offender, which is most of the time where you want to end up, because if the offender is a home computer in, say, South Korea, you'll probably be unable to explain to these people that their machine is being abused for phishing.
Sure.
You want to go fairly far upstream, in fact.
I agree with you that that's the intent of the changes made in the IP address Whois. I think that we're going to have to wait and see, practically speaking, if that's the effect.
Well, in a way, that's not our problem to solve right now.
Right. No, of course not.
I would actually like to come back to the point I made earlier. It's not just not being able to come down to the right kinds of rules. What we're dealing with here is, in a way, a textbook example in statistics. I'll ask you a question. Have you ever thought about why HIV tests are not applied to just the entire population? There is a statistical answer to that, and this statistical answer is you have a large majority of the population which is negative. You have such and such a failure rate of the test where you get false positives. If you do the math of applying the test to the entire population, you end up with more people being wrongly diagnosed positive than people actually having contracted the disease, actually being infected. That's the statistics in that case, and the accuracy of the test is pretty good. It's so good that you only apply it, it's so good that you can relatively reliably apply it to a population where you believe that there is a high probability of infection, that the people where you have a reason to suspect. This is the very same mathematics that you also, and the very same probabilities that we are dealing here in a generic way. It's the very same effect we are dealing with here. First, we are only dealing with cases of suspected inaccuracy. That's important. That's very important, because it means that we are looking at a population which is has a high likelihood of having inaccuracy in there. That's one point. The other point is we have to be careful that the population where anybody can apply the test is also small enough. That's the thing we can't do. So if we do just about anything that would apply a generic test with a reasonable, that would effectively apply a generic test with a fairly reasonable failure rate in the sense of false positives to a large population, then we are in trouble. So what we have to do is keep that trouble low. Make sure that the test that can be applied to a large population does not cause harm when it generates a false positive. That's the equivalent of saying, if you want to improve accuracy, if you want to apply the test in terms of random challenges, then you have to find ways which do not endanger domain name registrations. If you want to design a test where you have strong indications that something is wrong, that somebody is phishing, design that test very differently. You have to optimize your tests in different ways, depending on the population you apply them to. And that's in a way, that's a lesson here. You won't be able to find a single test that achieves both. It's not a matter of not agreeing to it. It's a matter of the statistics won't work out in practice. So you really have to separate the two problems. You have to separate the problem of accuracy improvements on a wide scale from the problem of dealing with offenders on a small scale. I think once we start doing this differentiation, we may have a chance of getting somewhere. But as long as we try to do the impossible, we won't be able to do it, very simply.
Does this conversation give us an option to go back to the constituencies, for you guys to go back to your constituencies and see if looking at it from Thomas's point of view changes any of the requirements that you would have for an acceptable policy?
We're going to want, I mean, I know the IPC is going to want some kind of verification, and I don't know that I necessarily agree with everything that Thomas has said.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe verification mechanism. And you know, the question is how to go about doing that. I think the issue is about which data elements to verify and how many, you know, at this point are open, and we need to think about that issue. But I'm quite certain that the IPC is going to want to proceed with some mechanism to verify data accuracy. So, but I do think that we've got to deal with some of these issues, particularly on the elements to verify. Ross, what would be your thoughts about the elements to verify? Is it your position now that the only element that would be verified or should be verified is the postal address?
No, I'm more concerned about implementing something that we can live with. We've not done that in the past with policies coming out of the IPC, and they're causing serious damage not only to the operational environment the registrars are dealing with, but to the Internet community in general. And I'm quite firm in that position that if we're not going to do something that makes sense with this task force, that I'm not going to endorse the result.
Right. I guess I'm asking you what would make sense.
Oh, I'm going to defer on that right now, Brian.
Okay.
I'm not sure that the answer is quite productive.
Okay. I think we've reached our sort of usual point in these discussions where it doesn't seem like it's going to be that fruitful to keep hashing over the same issues. I think it's interesting to look at it from Thomas's point of view, in the sense that trying to figure out if this is a more generic form of assuring accuracy for registrants, or whether it's a way of tracking bad actors, might help us figure out whether there's a cost-benefit ratio that makes sense. You know, certainly if it's a more generic form of verification, then I think you want lower costs. And I think if it's finding bad actors, then you know the IP constituency might be willing to bear some higher cost in participating in the verification process.
But let's not dance around that.
I think
Brian has made it quite clear that this is about ferreting out bad actors. And he's also made it quite clear that the IPC is not willing to pay for that. And I'm happy to have him correct me on both of those points, but I think that is very much in the public record at this point.
It's about identifying, about maintaining data accuracy, one of which purposes would be going after bad actors. I mean, that's certainly one use of the accurate data. And that's the purpose of
right. But I think Thomas's point is forcing everyone to submit to accuracy requirements that are intended to track bad actors is burdensome.
Yeah.
To those who are not bad actors.
Let's do this. Why don't we not meet next week? Why don't we schedule a workshop for Cape Town, and then just the task force. And who's ever present, and then try to hash out some of these issues and see, define a scope of how to proceed, if that's possible, and then see where we are at that point, and then make some decisions as to, you know, going forward or not. I think that probably makes some sense. What do people think about getting together in Cape Town?
I think everyone agreed at the beginning of the call that that sounded like a good idea. So,
yeah. Why don't we not meet next Wednesday then? And if Barbara, you and Glenn can work on setting something up for the task force members to get together, I don't know, for an hour maybe, whatever you guys think is reasonable, hour and a half, and then see where things are, and then we can decide whether or not there's a basis for going forward based on what we currently have and in what direction. Because I don't see the point in meeting next week. I know a lot of people are going to be traveling. And then the following week would be Cape Town. So I think that's probably the way to go. If you guys could set up that workshop via email, And I'll get with somebody at the IPC and make sure that one is there to represent the IPC in the at that workshop. And if the other constituencies can do the same, that would be helpful.
Okay, we'll Glenn and I'll figure out when on the schedule there's a reasonable time, and we'll post a couple of suggestions to the list, and you know, and see if that timing works for people, because I know that there's a lot of other meetings also being scheduled. So.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Good. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.